Okay, Parshat Vishalach, we are going to focus on one word today, but that one word is going to be more than a word, because it's actually what I want to get to is much more than that, to convey an attitude or a thought or a feeling or perhaps a state of mind that the people are in. So let's state the obvious. Some point between the end of last week's Parsha and the beginning of this week's Parsha, we left Egypt. And how did we leave Egypt? Did we leave Egypt like slaves who are, you know, turning, looking back and running away because we're afraid someone's chasing us? Or did we leave as slaves, or as former slaves and people with dignity? Did we leave as people who are heading towards the land of Israel, or for that matter, were we people who know that we have a rendezvous with God in the desert and we're heading towards Mount Sinai? For that matter, did we even know that we were headed towards Mount Sinai? How much information trickled down from leadership to the regular people? Was there an understanding? Was there a knowledge that right now the place that we're heading to is going to be Mount Sinai? Or as far as they're concerned, were... So they were supposed to go up the coast and go straight to the land of Israel, which it says in the very beginning. And when Paro sent them... So it's very interesting. It's not that he ran away, it's Paro sent them. So when Paro sends them, and this is something we've discussed a number of times, is it that at that point Paro just said, forget about them, and then there's a change of heart afterwards? Is there, shall we call it, seller's regret, that he says, hold it, what in the world did I just now do? Or as far as he's concerned, that old excuse that it was introduced in the very beginning, oh, we're only going for 3 days, that's what everyone is thinking. But again, what are the Jews thinking? What are the Egyptians thinking? What is Paro thinking? What is Moshe thinking? But putting it all together, we do know that we have a stop to make, which is along the way, which is back to Mount Sinai. And the reason we have that is because God said it to Moshe by the burning bush, that when you take the people out, you're going to come back and serve God on this mountain. So I know that it's there. I just don't know if anyone else knows that that's there. But you read that first pasuk again. V'yibashalach Paro ta'am v'lo nacham elokim derech eretz plishtim ki karofu. The other thing which is interesting is the use of the word Am. I think the simple reading of Am is the Jewish people, because those are the ones that Paro sent away. He sent the Jewish people. We know that there's also an Erev Rav that go with them, these other hangers-on, as it were, who go out with them. And later on in the Torah, especially in the book of Bamidbar, there's going to be some intrigue trying to figure out who is whom along the way. Does the term B'nai Yisrael mean one thing? Does the word the Am, the term the Am, mean something else? Is there consistency or not consistency? So I am not dealing with that right now, but perhaps we'll see at least one of the commentaries that deals with this. Ki amar Elokim ki nachama Am, right? The people, Ha'am, are going to themselves have regret, birotam milchama, when they see war v'shavu Mitzrayim and turn back to Egypt. So which war are they talking about? Apparently what God is talking about over here is the war to conquer the land of Israel. That's the only war that we really should have in mind. Paro sent us away, go, please leave. So as far as we know, we're done with Paro. Which means the thing which perhaps which for us is unanticipated at this point, is that Paro will change his mind and chase the people down and then come and have this meeting by the sea. And I will reiterate something which we spent a lot of time with a number of years ago, and that is that the splitting of the sea itself seems quite natural. It says that the wind blew the entire night, and as the people were participating in it, what had been water suddenly disappears. And again, the background for that is they seem to have made a wrong turn along the way, except for something we'll read in a moment. They seem to have made a wrong turn because they went up a peninsula, and when you go up to the end of the peninsula, you suddenly find yourself surrounded by water on three sides, and then the other side is the Egyptians coming at them, and that's it. They're stuck. There's no place for them to go. They're all three sides is water, and the other sides is Egyptians. That's it. There's no recourse. And then very slowly, and not dramatically, the way the Torah describes it is all night, the wind blows, and suddenly what had looked like it was water becomes dry land. So the miracle at the sea has the revealed miracle and the hidden miracle. The hidden miracle is the blue wind blowing all night that looks like a natural process. Of course, the most important thing about miracles is... Yeah, it's like a joke. What's the most important part about a joke? Is to say it right before people laugh. If that doesn't work, then you've blown the whole thing, right? You didn't realize that. Now you realize it's timing. So the same thing with the miracle. It's timing. But nonetheless, it does describe that all night a wind blows and it seems to be the water gets pushed away. Maybe years ago there was an archaeologist named Kathleen Kenyon who wrote all kinds of things about archaeology and about Israel and ancient Israel. And she did not believe in the Exodus story. And one of the reasons she didn't believe it, because she said that she couldn't find Jericho. So now after 1967, she kept on writing articles, the biblical Jericho. She kept on writing articles about Jericho, and she says there is no, I mean, there is no Jericho, and therefore there's no entrance into Israel, there's no conquest. And then at some, and she refused to come to Israel after 1967 because it was occupied territory, but she continued publishing her articles. And then somebody else around 8 miles away found a walled city. Now, normally if you're going to lay a city to siege, you'll surround the city, make sure that no food goes in, and therefore people will have lack of resources, and therefore they will end up starving. And when they starve, then you take your battering rams and you knock the walls in, and the walls are always smashed inward. So what they found in Jericho is they found this ancient city, they found food storages, there was food there still, and they found the walls, instead of being smashed in, the walls came out. They fell outwards. So the front page, so it was in a section of the New York Times, but there was a big article on this, and it writes, believer score of the Battle of Jericho, and I hope that was the article in the Times and not in an archaeological magazine, but then it said in the subtitle, scientists theorize that an earthquake destroyed the series of Jericho, because it was the only logical explanation, because why would there still be food, and why would the walls have fallen that way? So of course there must have been an earthquake. I think the reason I'm thinking about that, among others, is because they said it was an earthquake this morning up in the north of Israel today, and I hope you realize that that's exactly, if I'll try to remember to, and that was, and that came down, that's the fault. The fault goes right down to, yes, you knew this before you moved here? Okay, that the fault goes right there by Jericho. But I'm willing to say, actually, I absolutely believe that there was an earthquake, because what's an earthquake? Earthquakes, and but the most important thing is that it's timing. The Jews are standing outside, they walk around 7 times, they blow the shofar, and the wall comes down. Okay, so that's exactly what it describes, but still we have this need to try to put it within a natural explanation. So over here at the splitting of the sea, so the timing is the most important thing, but the more dramatic part is when the Egyptians come into the dry land and then the water comes smashing down on them. I mean, that was much more dramatic than the actual splitting itself, which has an allure of being perhaps somewhat natural, if you will, other than, of course, the very fortuitous timing. So let's just read the elements in these couple of verses one more time. Paro sends them, but God does not want them to go derech eretz plishtim, which is going up the coast, because going up the coast, they will then get into war almost right away. Which means, what war are we talking about over here? Not the Egyptians, who we don't know are chasing them, but rather this is going to be the beginning of the conquest for the land of Israel. So can you really have people that one day were slaves and the next day are going to be fighting for their independence? Well, the answer is, in 1948, the answer was, yeah, that really did happen. And there were people that came straight from the Holocaust and were handed weapons and said, and go fight, you know, for your people, which is not a very simple thing. But yeah, that absolutely did happen. So God says they're not going to be prepared. They may see war and turn around and go back to Egypt. V'yasev Elokim et ha'am derech hamidbar yam suf. And then God takes them this other way around. And the Jews left, and I will be difficult right now, and I will translate chamushim as chamushim. I will translate it as chamushim right now. We will chamushim, which means I'm not translating it. I just read the word. It says they leave chamushim. Okay, if you insist, then we will translate chamushim as armed. If you wish, okay. Although it doesn't have to be armed in the sense of weapons, it could be armed in the sense of supplies or preparedness or others. In modern Hebrew, chamush would be more have the indication of having arms on them. So let's say that they're armed. So then you have a beautiful irony between the first irony or contrast between the first verse and the second verse. God says they're not ready, and they think they are ready. So now you have machloket between God and between Am Yisrael. So what does God do? Well, God wins. But they do think they're ready to go and fight, and they're ready to go fight for the conquest, which means the land of Israel was promised to them. And if we'll go back and, you know, recognize something, when the Brit Bein Abtarim took place, and God promises that they'll be enslaved, and then they're going to go to the land of Israel. So the land of Israel is the next stop. They're ready for the next stop. And they're armed to go and to conquer the land of Israel, but God does not think that they're ready. Now, of course, with our later knowledge working backwards, I guess with the Super Bowl over, we can have also have a football reference with playing Monday morning quarterback, which probably means nothing to anybody outside of America, but and probably a whole bunch of people in America. But playing Monday morning quarterback, we realized 40 years later, you know what, they really weren't ready yet to go into the land of Israel. There are all kinds of ups and downs along the way. And one of the interesting things about this week's parsha is that there are lots of ups and downs. In a certain sense, this week's parsha is going to be a microcosm of those kinds of things, is that they're going to have the most dramatic, happy, religious experience, the splitting of the sea and the singing of the song of the sea and Uz Yashir. And then a moment later, they're going, you know, we have no water and what's going to be? And then God gives them water and then, oh, we have no food and God gives them man. And these ups and downs taking place. And then again, we have no water again. We have no water. And then, and then the most ironic thing happens is that Amalek comes and attacks them. You know, for people who aren't ready for war, and God takes them all the way around. So, okay, they're not ready to find the war, but the war goes and finds them. And how's that for also something which is quite unfortunate? So I'm saying there's so much in this week's portion which does make it somewhat of a microcosm. And this point that I made also, that they're really not ready, and therefore it's going to take 40 years. It's even, there's a hint of that in this week's portion. If you didn't notice it, there is a hint of that as well. Did anybody notice that? And I've pointed that out before as well, is when the man is introduced, it says, and the man came, and the God gave them man, and they proceeded to eat it for the next 40 years. So the 40 years is already mentioned over here. So this is either one of the greatest in muktam muktam muchars by Torah, namely that there's a lack of, how do we call this, chronological integrity. I actually went to speak someplace, and the fellow introduced me, said, as Rabbi Kahn, you know, I've used a term here, which I think he made up, which I think I did, which was chronological integrity, which we call en muktam u'muchar. So you have right there, or the other possibility is that when God dictates to Moshe the entire Torah, he adds in an editorial comment, oh, this man that I'm giving now, you know, it's even better than Uber Eats, if you have any idea what that is. So, you know, God gives them food, it comes directly to them, no, and that's going to go on for the next 40 years. Which is also going to be one of these wonderfully ironic things that the people will constantly complain. And I've pointed this out so many times. They're going to get up in the morning and say, where's Moshe? Who knows what's going on over here? And build a golden calf. And that morning they had mun, which they imagined tasted like waffles with maple syrup, cream, right? Whipped cream on it. And as they're eating this with their, you know, Starbucks coffee, they're saying, oh, like, where's God? Like, And with the spies and so on. Like every time something goes wrong, what are they eating for breakfast at that point? The mun had come down and still. So I'm saying this wonderful contrast between spiritual maturity and spiritual immaturity, it really gets played out in this week's portion. Okay. So God takes them around. And then, Pasuk Yutet v'yikach Moshe et atzmo Yosefimo. He takes Yosef's remains because there was a vow that was made, you know, please take me out when you leave, which actually means that they're leaving with at least one religious commandment being fulfilled. Take Yosef's remains out. V'yisumni sukot v'yachanu be'etam be'katzar ha-midbar, and they go, tells us where they travel. And Pasuk of Aleph, again, is going to be incredibly important. V'Hashem holech lefneim yomam ba'mud anan, so there is this absolutely miraculous cloud entourage which is leading them, following them, taking care of them, protecting them. And they have this total protection taking place in terms of this cloud. So Paro sends them. God is protecting them. They themselves feel that we can do it on our own, and we can take our weapons, if that's indeed what it means. Moshe, on the other hand, is taking Yosef's remains. And as I said again, we have this wonderful complexity all wrapped in just in these couple of psukim. And I told you that the main word that I want to get back to is the word chamushim. You're still troubled about what the word chamushim means, and you can tell me what Rashi says. It's okay. Let's start and look at what the commentaries say on this. Source number two, Targum Onkelos, who's always going to be our first turn, he says that he takes them, Vaschar Hashem Yat Ama Orach Midbara, Yama Desuf Umizarin, Umizarzin, which would be like zariz, like quickly, but it also can have the connotation of preparedness, that they go prepared, they go ready, they're ready. Targum Yerushalmi writes, Mizayanin, armed with weapons. So prepared and weapons, and I'm willing to admit that that could be the same or at least similar. Targum Pseudo-Yonatan writes, they go up the coast, V'kol chad chamisha taflin siliku, and each one comes with five children. I know it's not what you thought it's going to say, that each one of them has five children coming with them. My wife and I, having five children, are apparently very, very clever and fit into this Pseudo-Yonatan. So, Rashi. You've asked for Rashi. We will give you Rashi. Rashi, in his way, occasionally, will give us multiple interpretations onto what this phrase means. And whenever Rashi gives us multiple interpretations, we always need to question, why is Rashi giving us multiple interpretations? Why wasn't one interpretation sufficient? Vayehi bishala, Rashi writes, number five, v'chamushim. Ein chamushim ela mizuyanim. So Rashi tells us it means that they were armed, which means, what does this word, it's also, ein chamushim ela mizuyanim, that the word armed, packing heat for some of you, right? It means that they have weapons with them. That's what the word means. But it's interesting, Rashi didn't say, oh, it's possible. He goes, no, that's what it means. Ein chamushim ela mizuyanim, they are armed. Of course, being armed is something we also need to pay attention to. What are the arms that they have with them? They're probably going to be quite primitive. Do they have bows and arrows? Do they have, you know, these things made out of wood? Do they have actually things made out of steel? What do they have? But we know what the enemy has. The enemy has tanks. The enemy is going to be having these tanks being pulled by horses, which means there really is no comparison over here. As well as we think that we're armed, although let's go back and note that we don't necessarily know at this point that the enemy that we may have to face, and we're not going to face them in the end because God will take care of it, because look, we're being surrounded by the cloud. That's why I'm saying that this is all interconnected and that they're really armed, but we're not going to face them. And our arms, I'm going to say it again, more likely than not, are for the anticipated battle that will take place afterwards, which is, of course, the battle with the Canaanites. Or the Plishtim, or the Haknaniv, Ayuvusiv, Agrigiv, and so on and so forth. Then Rashi continues, and he says, L'fisha asiban bamidbar hu garam lam shalu chamushim, that once God took them in this path, that's why they needed to go armed. She'ilu hi sibam derech yishuv, if they would have gone in places that were inhabited, lo yu michumashim lem koma, then they wouldn't have taken everything with them because they would have figured whatever we need, we'll just pick up on the local makolet as we travel. You don't have to pack as much if you go into places that have things. So it's quite reasonable, Rashi here. Good advice for you for your traveling, what to schlep with you and what to pick up along the way. But when you go traveling in the desert, then you need to take with you everything that you may possibly need because you're not going to find that 7-Eleven off in the middle of the desert. And this is really being said to explain something. I'm explaining the metaphor. Because you shouldn't then go asking afterwards when they actually did find battle, even in this week's parasha, where do they have weapons from? That's why it's telling you already now that they took weapons just to be prepared, which means essentially they're being good Boy Scouts. Be prepared, take everything with you, because you never know, and anything you may need, take with you. And that was also actually a chesed, that's how Rashi's reading it. It's a chesed that God performed when an act of kindness, when he takes them around in the desert, because that's what caused them to prepare, and that's why they're going to have arms eventually when they do face Amalek. So this is like actually an inverse way of explaining how they prepared for battle when they really weren't prepared for battle, because taking them this way because they're not prepared for battle, because they can't go derech plishtim, prepares them for battle. So I hope that you appreciate the irony in that, or you even followed that. If not, then you didn't. He then brings some evidence for this, and we'll skip a little bit. V'chein tergamo unkelus mizurazin. And he says, yeah, and that's what unkelus means, that they were prepared. Kimo v'yarek et chanichav v'zarez. There, when Avram's about to go to war, and the four kings and the five kings, and he goes and he gets his people, his followers, to go get ready for battle, there, the word that unkelus used is v'zarez. So over there he uses vizariz, and over here he uses mizarizin. So therefore there was preparation for war. So therefore Rashi just now did a little nice unculus analysis saying, oh, that's what he means by getting ready for war. So till this point, Rashi is quite consistent. War, preparation, arms, and so on. And then Rashi does in his way, davar acher, and there's another interpretation. Chamushim, echad michamisha yatsu. Va'arba'a chalakim metu b'shloshet yimei afela. He goes, oh yeah, there's another interpretation, that chamushim comes from the word five, that only one-fifth left and four-fifths of the Jewish people, 80% of the Jewish people died in Egypt during the 3 days of darkness. And that's such an amazing and difficult statement. The Rashi sort of like throws that away at the end. And for Rashi, this is not a throwaway. I mean, Rashi is going to tell us this in very clear terms. Actually, he told us in very clear terms last week. But Rashi didn't just throw this out. And I'm not going to say that this is exactly what he's doing. But Rashi, in a certain sense, reflects the Mechilta, which is in source number 6, which actually starts with by saying, V'chamushim, ein chamushim el mizuyanim. That what does it mean? That it means that they are armed. Well, but that was word for word Rashi. That's exactly what he said. So you realize that Rashi has the Mechilta or other parallel sources that say the same. What does it mean that they were chamushim? It means they were armed. And then he brings the verse to try to prove this. Davar Acher, another interpretation. So what did Rashi do? He took the Mechilta with the Davar Acher. He just took both sides of the Mechilta. Why choose between them? But that's also interesting. Why say both? But V'chamushim alu achad mechamisha. One in five left, which means what percentage is that? 20%. V'yeshomim, some say, achad mechamishim, one in 50. You just got down to 2%. V'yeshomim achad mechamesh meot. And some say 1 in 500. So now you're down to 0.2%. So look at Rav Nahurai, the next line, Omer, Ha'avodah, lo echad mechamesh me'ad alu. He goes, what are you talking about? Don't exaggerate it so much. Shenema revavaket semach hasadena taticha v'ktiv uvnei Yisrael paru v'yishritzu v'yirbu v'yatzmu b'ma'od. Now the quote of the Mechilta does not add the end of the pasuk, but ma'od ma'od. But I'll point out what my suspicion is about how they got to this number. What did just now say before? That when kishaita isha yoledet shisha b'keres achad, that every time a woman was pregnant, she gave birth to six at a time. So if on my source right over here, because I sit down and actually look at them with a cup of coffee before I leave the house in the morning, so it's somewhat fresh in my mind. So I actually numbered this. Paru, I wrote 1. V'yishritzu, 2. V'yirbu, 3. V'yatzmu, 4. But then there are 2 more words in the pasuk. B'ma'od, 5. Ma'od, 6. I think that's where the Mechilta is getting this interpretation from, is because the verse describing how many children has six references or 6 words talking about how many there were. So I think that's the number 6 over here. So it's saying is that they had this almost supernatural amount of children being born. Of course, the irony then is that then they're going to lose most of them, which is really quite difficult. Vata omer chad mechamesh meot alu, havuda lo chad mechamesh meot alu, ela shemetu harbei miyisrael b'mitzrayim, ve'eimatai meitu b'shloshet me'afila. When did they die? They died during those days of darkness. And now you realize what Rashi did over here. One second. But you should realize something by now, that every time you have a good question, don't I answer to it at some point during the class? Eventually. So, we will try to get back to that point. Correct. 100% I agree. And there are those who agree even stronger than 100%. But give me a moment over here. What Rashi has done is he has simply mirrored the Mechilta. I want to say simply. Again, the Mechilta is a little richer. There's one other comment in the Mechilta which I absolutely love and is a blessing, you know, for all of us when we sit around the Pesach Seder, that we should get to this point. Rabbi Yossi Omer v'chamisha dorot alu. There were 5 generations that left. That's the Chamushim, is the 5 generations. So what is that going to be? The great-great-grandparents and the great-grandparents and the grandparents and the parents and the children and all those generations together marched out of Egypt together. So that's really such a beautiful thought and turn on this chamushim. Again, the issue with the chamushim is the root, is it has to do with being armed or preparedness, or does it have to do with the word chamesh, number five? And those who said number five, okay, so which number five is it? Is it going to be number five in terms of five or 50 or 500 and so on and so forth? The Zohar also has an interesting turn on the five, and it mentions the various things, V'chamushumu lo b'nei Yisrael, source number seven, Chad mi'chamisha, so first it starts with our 20%, Rabbi Yossi omer chamisha mi'Yisrael v'chad mi'nayhu. It's the percentage between the Jews and the Eir of Rav and the others that left with them. So that's the chamushim, is that we were 80%, but it was an 80-20 split between those who came with us and followed us out of Egypt, which, again, you know, sometimes people ask me, so, you know, why do you go to the Zohar? So I go to the Zohar because there's really interesting comments in the Zohar and not necessarily greatly Kabbalistic or otherwise. It's interesting. Okay. The Rashbam in Source 8 says something which I hinted at earlier, so I just want you to see that he's the one who actually said it. The chamushim b'klei zayin, again, straight off, unlike his grandfather Rashi, he doesn't give us the more dramatic 80% died in 20. What does the word mean? It means they were armed. It says they armed. Why? Shehu holchim liyirashat eretz Yisrael. Because the next stop, as far as they know, is the land of Israel. But that's all they were told. I'm taking you out, going to the land of Israel. Okay, let's go prepare. Let's go. Let's also see. Okay, let's look at the Ibn Ezra. We'll just note now there are going to be two comments of the Ibn Ezra because the Ibn Ezra wrote different books. But you know what? Before the Ibn Ezra, let me just do first number 11, which is the Bechor Shor, one of the Baalei HaTosfot. And he says, Shehayu imem mizonot kedei laspik otam derech rachok. That what does chamushim mean is that they were prepared, but prepared with food. And what, again, you tell me right now, before we got to this verse, I told you the Jews left Egypt, what did they leave with? Matzah. And what else? What else did they leave with? All the money from that. So therefore, don't be surprised if we're going to find commentaries, we'll say, again, our theory of conservation of supplies. Which means if we know that they left with food, so someone's going to say, oh, they left with food. That's what it means, chamushim. They're all loaded up. Prepared with food. How much food do they have? Enough food for all of the 600,000 and plus some to eat for 30 days. That's a great deal of food that they had. Second opinion, another opinion is going to be, well, what do we know? Well, that was based on last week's class. What do they leave with? They left with all of the jewelry. So therefore, they left with all of the jewelry. So if you just look at 11 and 12, 11 is the Bechor Shor. They left with mizonot. They left with enough food. You look at the Reb Chaim Paltiel, who's also from the Baalei HaTosfot. He says, Pirish ki Baalei Otzrot sheshalu klei kesef klei zahav. What are they loaded down with? They're loaded down with all the jewelry. So it's interesting that they both took the same approach and gave different conclusions, but it really is the same thought process. What do we know that they left with? And therefore, let's just fill in the blanks over here. And that's going to be either the food or it's going to be the jewelry. Now let's go back to the Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra is going to have two different comments because he wrote at least two different commentaries, and he wrote the two different commentaries at different points in his life when he had different audiences. And also he was older at one point and he came in contact with others among the Rashbam. Among the Rashbam's teachings, which means he moves from Spain to France. Ibn Ezra was a wanderer. He wandered from place to place. Ibn Ezra apparently ended up in England at some point, and he was actually the subject of a poem of one of the British poets, and that will then be your homework to find out which poet and to read the poem called Ibn Ezra. Okay, so should I tell you who? Browning. So, source number nine. It's number nine, verse number nine, I believe. V'chamushim. Yesh omrim mileim hon. Some people say that they left with a great deal of monies. Now you realize that was one of the Baalei HaTosfot that had said that. Sheyesh lam kol tzrichayim. They knew they had everything they needed. V'nei katuv, and it says it. V'gam tzeda lo asu lahem, ma tam laskir za'ata, v'rak, right, one second. V'rak perusho chagurei chomesh lamilchama. But rather what this really means is they left with arms for war. And he does a little fancy interpretation there to get to this, but he says that's clearly what it means. I'm skipping two lines. V'tam laskira katuv v'chamushim v'makom hazeh, ki l'mala katuv v'rotam milchama, ki b'yad ramah yatzu b'klei milchama, v'lo kamu avadim borchim. They left, and again, it's the state of mind that I wanted to really get, that's why we're going here, is that they left prepared for battle. We will fight for our freedom. It's Browning.
There you, Rabbi,
there you go. There you go.
Do you want to do a dramatic reading?
No, no, no. Source number 10 is the Ibn Ezra's Perish HaKatzar, his short commentary. Of course, I know what you're all thinking right now. Why is his long commentary 5 lines and his short commentary 20 lines? Okay. That's what happens sometimes. So I'm going to tell you what he says. And then if you want, we'll read it. What he says is that to say that 80% died and 20% less is preposterous mathematically and is absurd theologically. Is that strong enough? If you want, you can say it the other way around. Preposterous theologically and absurd mathematically. V'chamushim, here he writes, it means they were armed. And he brings a verse to indicate it, which was the same one in the Perish Katzar. End of the second line, v'darash. And there is a drash. Shalu achad michamesh meot. By the way, notice when he's going to pick on this tradition, he went to the biggest one. Some will claim that only 1 in 500 left. Devar yachidhu. He said that is an isolated, independent opinion, a solitary opinion. V'alav machloket. And people certainly argue with that. V'nenu kabbalah klal. And there's no tradition to such a teaching. Which means he's telling you, in other words, he thinks that it is wrong. Okay, wrong. 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 V'day lenu hatzar shanachnu bo im chachmei Yishmael. It's bad enough, the discussions that we have with the scholars of Islam, shehem omrim eich yitakein michamishim v'chamesh zecharim shirlidu b'matayim v'esr shanim sheish mot elev zecharim miben esrim. Who've questioned how, according to their math, at least there were 55 males. How did those 55 males over a period of 210 years somehow become 600,000 males? He goes, it's hard enough to work out this math, but you're going to tell me now, but only 1 in 500 left, and in reality, therefore, that's not the number, but you have to multiply that by 500. And he's saying, please don't do this to us, because you're going to make us look really bad in front of people that can do math. And it's bad enough as it is. And then he does actually go into the math a little bit, and he actually defends it. Along the way, he's going to say that in 46 years, Yaakov had 69 descendants. So if then each one of his descendants over the next 69 years had 40, had so over the next 46 years had themselves 69 descendants, he does believe you can get to the kind of numbers that we need to get to. And that's what he does in the next couple of lines over here. So you can see some of the Ibn Ezra's math in this, and I'm not going to read all of it, but that's what he does. And then he comes to your point about people dying during the days of darkness. And he says, and what in the world are you talking about? But let me just go a little bit before that. And right in the middle, 2 lines before, we have the underline at the end of Zuvisof, Mea Vishmonim Vishtaim, Yiyu Yotermi Elef Alafim, and so on, Elef. And he does think that he can get to the right amount of numbers if you say that they really were that many kids being born. Okay. Viaspiku, it's enough, but don't go to 500. He says, don't go to 1 in 500, because then I can't do the math anymore. V'od ki akatuv omer al makat orev v'samti p'dut ben ami u'ben amecha. He goes, but let's pay attention. When one of the plagues called orev comes in, it says that the stated one of the goals is to make a distinction between the Jews and the non-Jews, and I have to pause here for a moment. Those of us who went to yeshiva, one of the things we learned when we were very young is that from the very first makah, from the first plague of blood, we would have like pictures of workbooks of the Egyptians drinking blood out of a straw, and then very romantic, both drinking out of the same soda cup, and then the Jew drinking out of that same soda cup is going to have water, right, water coming out, and that would show the distinction. And that's a wonderful understanding, and it's mentioned by some of the Midrashim, and it's not mentioned in the text, that by the Makah of Dam, there's no mention that there was a distinction, which means the Ibn Ezra over here is going to be very careful. Yes, from a rabbinic perspective, every one of the 10 plagues distinguished between the Jews and the Egyptians, but he's saying, well, let's look what the text actually says. It says it by Orev, continue, he says, then afterwards by the flocks, v'nei b'kam, right? I am now in the Ibn Ezra, source number 10, two-thirds of the way down, right after it's underlined. Exactly, exactly. And then he says, okay, fine, we'll go right there then. And also by the Makkah of the, there was not even, it says that the Egyptian flocks died and not even one flock or one animal of the Israelites died. Ubimakat b'chorim, comes death of the firstborn, it says, lo meit b'Yisrael echad, not even one died. Ubimakat choshech, it said, by darkness it said, ulechol b'nei Yisrael haya'or, and among the Jews there was light, which means four of the 10 plagues tells us of a distinction between the Egyptians and the Jews. Now, one of those four was darkness or light. And he says, so therefore the Jews had light. During the plague of the firstborn, when Egyptians did die, Jews didn't die. You're going to tell me that during darkness, when no Egyptians died, that 80% of the Jews died? He's actually doing the extreme number over here. How are you going to say that only, what would this be? This would be 0.2% remain. That nine, right? That so many Jews died during this period. And therefore, that wouldn't really be light. If everybody's dying, if over 99% of the Jews just now died, how could a verse in the Torah describe that? And the Egyptians had darkness and the Jews had light. You didn't have light. You have everybody dying. So he says, what are you talking about? How can you possibly say such a thing? And you realize he took the larger number to pick on, but if it was 80%, is that much better? So he continues and he says, Rak machshechei Dever va'afelat mavet, because that's the case, there would be darkness of death and not light at all. Va'achur shelo nishar ki'im chela katan me'am rav, and therefore such a small percentage of the Jews remained, hine lo hayta gulat li'Israel ki'im ra'a chola. And he goes, and if so few Jews survived, that would not be considered to be salvation, but rather utter destruction. V'zeh hefach ha'katuv, and it's the opposite of what the text actually says. The klal drashu, and all of this is somebody's imagination, and it's a drasha. And then he says, "Ve'ein l'smoch alav," and do not trust this. V'ulay she'omru b'tchila hayelosod, and maybe the first one who said it had some kind of a secret that they wished to convey, which has been lost along the way, and then people went and took it literally, and he said that this would be quite unfortunate. And yes, he is making his point about the 1 in 500, but what he's saying is also true if it was 1 in 50, and what he's saying is also true if it's only 1 in 5 survive. If 80% of the Jews died during darkness, it's very difficult to imagine how we can then look at that and say, wow, that was salvation, and that was light. Before we finish today, I want to come back to a comment of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, where I believe he read this Ibn Ezra, and I believe that then he decided to reveal what he felt was the secret. But I say the secret, not necessarily the meaning at the time, but for him a revealed meaning. But give me a little bit of time, and I hope to get to that before I finish. We did the Bechor Shur. We did 11 and 12, right? But that's the next. That's during Makat Bechorot. That's afterwards. I know. You're just repeating the Ibn Ezra right now. The Chizkuni in source number 13, it says v'chamushim, mashapirish Rashi mizuyanim lo malacha lo mneshahu yiraim in Mitzrayim. Not because they were afraid. And again, this goes back to the state of mind. We are not afraid of the Egyptians. We left there. We're not afraid of them anymore. But we have to go conquer our land. We have to go and become an army. And we have to go in and take what's ours. And that is the way that Chizkuni understands this. Right. He also mentions the food afterwards. Let's look at the Ramban. Source 14. V'yesh Omrim, the Ramban writes, Shesipera katuv shiyatsu biyad rama, v'chashvu liyot ge'ulim. So this goes back to one of the questions that I raised in the very beginning. How did they leave? So he said they did not leave like slaves. They left as free people. And having arms was an expression of their freedom. I'm not going to get into the Second Amendment right now, but this was an expression of what they felt was being a free person now and not being somebody who was persecuted. If you look at 13, which is a pasuk from our parasha, I think this is what he has in mind. He didn't bring this, but I think he has in mind. The pasuk says, "V'chazek Hashem et leif Paro melech Mitzrayim v'yodov acharei b'nei Yisrael." So this is the part of hardening his heart to chase them down in order to perish by the sea. Uvnei Yisrael yotzim biyad rama. And they left with yad. Now, what does yad rama mean? So yad rama would be an outstretched, a strong hand out. So that could come very close to this idea of chamushim or with strength. But look at the Targum Onkelos on that. Uvnei Yisrael nafku b'resh gali. With a revealed head, as it were, but what it means is with their heads held high. Yeah. Later on in the Tochacha, this will be referred as the beginning of the Tochacha by Dvar, as Koma Miyut, as standing very, very tall, very strong. So the Jews leave, I think this is what the Rabban is saying, is they left at that point as free people. We are free, and therefore the arms are an indication of this. Rabbeinu Bechaye in 17 will tell us something which may or may not be relevant today. He says, why do they take arms with them? Because they may have battle. Now, remember, two verses later we're told, but God has these clouds that are protecting them, right? These divine clouds, which actually do a pretty good job by the splitting of the sea. Well, they don't do a great job necessarily by the war with Amalek, which is something that we have to consider, but not now. He says, Yetzu Yisro Mimitzrayim Chalutzim Kan Sheit Tzava HaYotzim L'Milchama. They left his people ready for war. And even though the Jews didn't need to arm themselves like all other peoples, that how should one behave? One should always do things as if nature will follow its normal rules, and then God will do the miraculous. So he says, of course, that, you know, he says during a time of war, a person needs to join the army. During a time of battle, during a time of danger, you need to take up weapons. But isn't it God who really protects us? Of course God is really protects us, but we need to still do things, what's called derech ha-teva. And there's all kinds of, what I would say, sometimes silly discussions about this in terms of the modern state of Israel. And sometimes it gets to, as I'll say, points of silliness, because of course people sitting in yeshiva will be told that it's their learning or davening which absolutely is what wins battles. Okay, could be. I'm not. It's out of my pay grade. I don't know how God actually works. But his point over here is that you need the army in order to do this, in order to facilitate the miraculous. A number of years ago, when there was a war going on in the south, and it hit right during the summer, which was then Bein Hazmanim. And then a lot of the yeshivas said, oh, the guys in the yeshivas are off. And said, hold on, what happened? I thought it was the learning. And there were some yeshivas who said, no, there's no vacation. I think Rav Adi Yosef said, there's no vacation. Because he says, listen, if we really believe that our learning and davening is going to help, you can't go on vacation during a war. You know, when during a war, you need to be prepared. So at least take yourself seriously. Don't make a joke out of everything. But nonetheless, Rabbeinu Bechaye goes further and says that you need to at least go through the motions. You need to be soldiers. Otherwise, this doesn't work well. That was 17. That's the only one you're going to remember. Okay. Who are you going to yell at? Look in the middle of that source. Elo sheratzon haTorah b'kach sheyaseh adam b'derech hateva kol ma shebiyado lasot v'ashar yaniach b'yado shamayim. A person must do everything they can possibly do in the natural way, and then God will take care of the rest. But you need to, right? You have to at least buy the lottery ticket if you want to, right? If you don't buy the lottery ticket, it's going to be hard to win the lottery, right? That's the derech hateva. Okay, that's the retirement plan. Okay, good. The Sforno actually says the opposite of what we saw before in the Ramban. In 18, v'chamushim alu, v'kol zehut tzorch lasot, afa pisho yimuzuyanim, ki im kol klei zinam, lo yalehem omitz lev lilachem b'mitzrayim, lo malet ki lo nasu be'ela. Even though they had primitive weapons, they were terrified. And they had no experience fighting, and there was still the psychological issue I'm embellishing, that these are the masters and we're the slaves, and therefore they took their primitive weapons, but they were afraid. They were scared, which really gives you a completely different picture. The Al-Sheikh in 19 is going to say the Am over here is the Erev Rav. The Erev Rav were the ones who were afraid, and the Jews were, and therefore all the problems are going to happen in the desert. I mean, that's really the direction he's going to go, and the Jews were not afraid, so that was 19. Okay. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and this is not what I wanted to tell you yet about him, he says that Chamushim means groups of 50, that these are army divisions. And he says that throughout, whenever there's going to be a census, one of the things that people note is that there's always, they're counted by numbers of 50s, and that's always the people going to war. He says, of course, because a pluga in those days was 50, that's a unit, that's a number of army, and Chamushim means that they were in groups of 50s, ready for battle in plugot, and this is a military term being used over here, so that's a number 20 over here, and he says, Shabiarti, another place that I explained, Parshat Pinchas, Shaplugata Tzava Eitz Yisrael Yubinot Chamishim, Ish Kol Echad, each 150 people, Vishizeh Kavanata Pasuk Chan, that is the intention here as well, V'chamushim Alu B'nei Yisrael, Hainu Sheheim Alu B'sedu Tzva'i, Shal Plugot Shabinot Chamishim Anshei Tzava. They went up in military formation, in groups of 50, ready for battle, so it's even stronger than some of the others that we saw before. In Source 21, we're told that God is going to lead them out. This is the Midrash Rabbah. And God did not take them in that other shorter way. Lama. Why? There was one tribe that left early. Why? Or some members of the tribe. Why? Because they did the math wrong. They counted the 400 years from Avraham instead of 430 years from Avraham. And 30,000 of Ephraim were killed at this point. Not realizing the number 400 was from the birth of Yitzchak, rather they counted from when God spoke, and they said 400 years are up, it's time to leave. This is, I think, also a veiled reference to those who try to predict when salvation or redemption will come. I think historically, anybody who's predicted when Mashiach is going to come has been wrong, except for those whose the dates hasn't happened yet, but everyone who's ever predicted has been wrong so far, which is why it's really silly to do. But then he goes on to say something which is amazing. He says, but their remains were along the way, Derech Eretz Plishtim. And he says that the detour was, look towards the bottom on the next page, he says, Kach Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, four lines from the bottom, source 21, Kach Amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, Yu Misavivim Et HaDerech, I'm going to take the long way around, Kedei Shelo Yiru Atzmot Acheihem, Mushlachim BaDerech V'Yachzeru LeMitzrayim. That they're going to see war means, they're going to see those who lost the previous war, and their dead bodies are along the way. And let me, Ma'asa Kadosh Baruch Hu, Natal Damam Shel B'nei Ephraim V'Taval Bo Kelav Kibachol, and so on and so forth. And he says, and that's why God took them a different way. So it's actually a very frightening piece. But notice something. Who was ready to go and ready to fight and ready to, you know, it's Ephraim. So it's interesting, the remains of Yosef are there. Ephraim is ready to go. By the end of the Parsha, somebody from Ephraim is going to lead the battle, and that's Yehoshua. So in case you're wondering, hold it. You know, is that just a coincidence? Well, it's not a coincidence. Yosef is a lover of Israel. Benot Slavchad, if you want to give the Dratar about them, that could be your starting point. They're lovers of Israel. Yosef is a lover of Israel. He wants to return to Israel. The people from Ephraim want to go back to Israel. Yoshua is the one who's ready to go in and to lead the conquest, and he will lead the conquest along the way. Okay. Now, this whole thing about people dying during darkness is based on source number 22, where it says that there was darkness, but the Jews had light. Rashi there says something remarkable. When we were watching it before, when we were quoting Rashi before, it sounded like a throwaway at the end. Dover Ache, oh yeah, but there's another point that 80% died. In source 23, V'yicholshech afeila shloshat yamim, there were 3 days of darkness. Rashi says, Choshech shel ofel, shelorru ishet achiv, otan shlosha yamim. People couldn't see one another for 3 days. V'od shloshat yamim achirim, choshech muchpal alze, shelor komu ish mitachtav, Yosef, and so on. V'lama hevi aleim choshech, third line, shayu b'Yisrael ba'otor dor rishaim. There were wicked people in that generation. The definition of wickedness, v'lo yirotzim latzeit. They did not want to leave. They wanted to stay in Egypt. That was wickedness. Umeitu b'shloshet me'afila. And those are the ones who died. And then in order that the Egyptians not know who died, that's why there was darkness for the Egyptians. So Rashi, who said that in passing, that 80%, here he doesn't say 80%, but he said, yeah, there were Jews who didn't want to leave, and those died. If you put the two Rashis together, then Rashi's going to say that 80% did not want to leave. Which leads me to the last source for today, which we have to do because I promised this to you. I don't know if I've ever read this before, if I've taught this before. I think I did once, but if I didn't, then... Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and again, note, 1891-1986, he was born in Europe, he studied in Slobodka, he came to America, he's Rosh Hashiv in Torah Vidas. He lived at a point, he was in Toronto, he lived in New York, he lived in Muncie, and he was really one of the great Talmidei Chachamim in the history of American Jewry. And he goes through a whole bunch of the sources that we've read today. And here he's commenting, he's the one who said before that it was the plugot was 50, groups of soldiers were 50. Here he writes that Rashi says that a lot of the wicked died. Perish Rashi, v'lami v'aleim choshech sh'ibnei Yisroel b'to ador rishayim v'lo yurotzim latzeit u'meitu v'shul sh'mei afila. Hine af she'bemet kol b'nei hador ha'hu lo yunechshavim k'tzadikim. He said, if we'll be honest for a second, we have rabbinic teachings which will tell us that all of them were no great righteous people. How do I know that? He tells us. Before the splitting of the sea, the angels come and complain to God, why are you splitting the sea and performing a miracle to save the Israelites when they're idolaters and the Egyptians are idolaters? And this is after we've gotten rid of, you can decide, 80% or a lot more percent of the wicked. He goes, these were still considered, the ones who remained were still considered wicked. The malachim at that point make a complaint, and it was indiscernible the difference between them and the Egyptians. So why did then only the 80% die? Not all of them die. All of them are wicked. Vinira, mishum she'elu hayu rotzim la'akev b'dayim shel ha'cherim milatzeit. That what was the wickedness of those who stayed? Not just that they stayed and didn't want to leave, they try to stop anybody from leaving. What are you, crazy? You're going to go to Israel? What kind of place is that? It's dangerous. You'll never make it. Stay in Egypt. It's much better. I'm just telling you what it says. Dehem savru shemekivin shekabala biyadam sheyishtabdu arba ma'ot shana imkein adayin lo igiyaz manaketz. He goes, because they had a tradition that they're going to be enslaved 400 years. Not counting from the birth of Yitzchak. We're supposed to be here 400 years. And 400 years isn't up yet. By the way, I'm going to put words in Rabbi Yaakov's mouth. He is putting a Satmar argument in their mouths right now. The time isn't there yet. How can you go before God said it's time to go? Upachadu she'im yatzu kodem azman, if they leave earlier, az yiru lehem kamo she'ir levnei Avraham she'yatzu mikodem azman. If they leave earlier, it's against the will of God. What's going to happen to them is what happened to the people from Ephraim. V'lo yiminu l'dveri Moshe v'zekeinim she'chishev Hashem et haketz b'zchut avot. And they did not believe the words of Moshe and the elders who said, no, God did the math creatively. And God counted the way that he wanted to count. This is God's job, not your job. And God killed them because they didn't want to leave and try to stop other people from leaving. Now, what he's about to get in and to say, maybe it's predictable for some of you, but it's really amazing. Even though the angels thought that they were idolaters, yeah, they were at this moment idolaters, but only God can look into their hearts and know that in 7 weeks from now, they'll have the ability of standing by Mount Sinai and saying, Naseh v'nishma, that we accept the Torah on ourselves, and we will be transformed. Upnimiut kazu gam malachim in margishimba, and the angels can't see such depth. Ad shehutzrach HaKadosh Baruch Hu lochiach and he quotes a midrash that in order for God to tell the angels to be quiet, he says, look, there's Yosef at Tzaddik over there, and all these people come from the same. They come from the same family, and don't worry about it. These people will be okay. I could also claim that Yosef on the outside maybe also didn't look like such a tzaddik, but we know that he really was Yosef at Tzaddik. Just to draw a parallel that I had sort of hinted at before, that It could be that in 1948 or 1945 or 1930 or 1920, that people who were perceived as being the secular Zionists were, the angels could have said, Elu Avodei Zarah. So who would have or could have predicted what would be the state of Israel today? I mean, there were those who predicted it would never last this long. There were those who predicted that the secular ideology of the state, by this point in time, all these years later, will have completely have won over, and this will be an absolute secular state. And I think that anybody with any sensitivity knows that the state is far more outwardly and in essence religious than it was in 1948. But you have to listen to the end of what he's about to say. You can't leave. You have to listen to the end. We have to listen to the end. And then he says as follows, and he's going to get to the feelings of the people, but he's going to draw a parallel. And I do believe that this was his read of that Ibn Ezra. Maybe there's a secret here. Minitzayer na la'atzmenu, mahi tahar geshatam shel b'nei Yisrael. If we would only imagine our minds, what they must have felt like. B'meshach yimei makat choshech, during those days when those people died. Again, he's accepting that tradition, and you'll see why. That the Jews are suffering more than the Egyptians. You know, even if you want to say the angel, to say they're idolaters and they're idolaters, but the Egyptians survive, and the Jews at that point are in darkness, the ones who are dying. Sorry, 80% died, and we have 600,000 men between the age of 20 and 60. He's doing the math over here. Then altogether, you have 2 million men, and you have another 2 million children, you have another 2 million women, and look what number Rabbi Yaakov just now got at as he's writing this. And who could have imagined a reason, a rationale for so many people to die? And certainly people were in shock and saying, what did God do to us? And then he writes, and he wrote this at the end of World War II. And that's the only thing that can bring us any kind of comfort at this time. That we are, I'm going to translate it as devastated, but you can obviously translate it differently, with the way that God has run the world. And we don't understand it. That's really what he's saying. And we have complaints against God. He does say that. When it comes to the state of the Jewish people, according to this, that all these people, 6 million died right before they left. Mashma, he says, sha'anu krovim l'geula. So he concludes, it must be, if we just lost so many, we're really, really close to the redemption.